Welcome back to Red Star Radio. It's the weekend edition, and we thought we'd come to you with a nice, safe, uncontroversial topic to be with you over the weekend. Something that isn't going to stir up a lot of emotions, or maybe get one or maybe two of us insulted by calling us members of the Nation of Islam or something. Layla, what safe and entirely bland topic are we covering today?
I am so excited to get into trouble and get canceled for defending temperance, which honestly is like the best thing, in my opinion, ever. One of the best things to come out of Britain. Like probably one, like after calculus, after like Shakespeare, you know, temperance. The temperance movement was one of the best things ever. And I'm so sad I only just pretty much learned about it recently. My learning about it was prompted by a podcast, a British podcast that Alex introduced me to called In Our Time.
Yes, it's one of the few things I can listen to on the BBC without wanting to start a riot.
It's a really good podcast. Recommend the episode specifically on temperance for those who want to get more historical background to the political aspects that we'll be highlighting in this show. But it truly is an inspiring story, and it's very much misrepresented in popular culture and kind of forgotten and buried under a lot of other concepts that tend to get highlighted within working class and trade union history. And that's why, you know, it was good.
Yes. Yeah. If they have to completely bury it, it's why, you know, there's something worth studying there, much like Hoxha's Albania.
Exactly. This learning about temperance, it felt the same way as I did when I was learning about Albania. I was like, wow, I can't believe this happened. Like, I can't believe this was real. I can't believe these people were actually able to accomplish what they did. And I know Alex wrote a great essay about temperance that I'll be publishing the Bellows soon. But, you know, people view temperance and they view prohibition as failures, as abject failures, and they kind of make fun of it, right? But actually, when you look into it, and you, especially when you apply a dialectical lens, they were extremely successful. And I think it's probably one of the most successful social movements in modern history, actually.
I'm sitting, of course, in a city which is very much associated with both trends, or I'm in a region of England which is associated with both trends, like the temperance movement, specifically the working class end of it, that headed by Joseph Livesey and others who came out of like the Preston area of Lancashire. The emergence of the temperance movement as a mass phenomenon in the 1830s comes about, and I do mention this in the essay, because of you've got this rapid urbanization, rapid industrialization, pushing of millions of people into these new forms of living and working. With it come just a massive amount of alienation and, of course, a massive amount of social problems, including rampant alcoholism made worse after the bourgeoisie had a really good idea and decided to completely deregulate alcohol, basically, on the provision of alcohol with the Beer Act of 1830. And this, as Engels demonstrated in his writing on in the book Condition of the Working Class in England, led to like mass drunkenness, or helped lead to mass drunkenness. And he mentions how people would get their wages on Friday, everything would be spent, and you could tell that people had spent everything because the pawn shops would all fill up with like every single possession some of these people had, which would then be slowly bought back over the course of the next week. And then Engels says, and slowly they'd run out of money even to like redeem the pledge on their pawned possessions. And Marx mentions when he in Capital Volume 1 how the children who are working in the potteries, which is the Midlands, around Stoke, Port Vale, places like that, where the English pottery industry used to be based, because they were working with long hours with so many chemicals, these like children, teenagers knew they were probably going to be dead before the age of 30. So whenever they got time off, would just drink themselves half to death. And this is the background under which, first of all, the working class temperance movement, there was always like a petty bourgeois temperance movement, but the teetotaler end of it, represented by Joseph Livesey and others, emerges as a real working class response to a huge problem. And it goes very much hand in hand with the formation of like the working class movement in Britain. Specifically, it goes hand in hand in a lot of areas with Chartism. And the influence that it has lasts well into the 20th century, because a lot of the early trade union leaders and early Labour Party people were very much influenced by the Joseph Livesey and the temperance movement. So people like Tom Mann is a very famous English trade unionist, early Labour MP John Burns, Keir Hardie was the first leader of the Labour Party in Parliament, and George Lansbury, and of course later Labour MP, Labour leader Philip Snowden. And teetotalism, the influence of the temperance movement had a big, big say in the early development of the Labour Party. Tony Benn used to say the early Labour Party was more influenced by Methodism than Marxism, and that had a lot of negative effects as well. But it's largely true. I mean, the Marxist influence in the early Labour Party was not what it was in the SPD in Germany or even in Italy or France. But the influence of like radical Methodism was certainly big, very big. And also the influence of a certain type of like Victorian liberalism that was adopted by a lot of the early working class radicals, and the idea of improving your personal standards, improving your personal morals. And this became a big concern for Joseph Livesey and the other early temperance, working class temperance campaigners, because they had the idea that one of the things that was holding the working class back was just that they had been essentially demoralized completely by their work, and also by the vices of capitalist society that were being pushed on them, particularly drink. And that by actually, and a lot of the Chartists fought this as well, that if the working class could like stand upright, purge themselves of reliance on drink, either adopt an attitude of a restrained attitude or to quit it entirely, not only with, of course, they would be living a more responsible life, they would be saving more of their money, not blowing it in the pub, but also that then they could show, and this is the sort of what Marx would deem to be a bourgeois point of view, they could show that they were good, respectable citizens who were ready for political rights. And this is a point of view of some of the temperance leaders and quite a few of the Chartist leaders, was that we as the working class, we have to be purer than pure. We have to give up all these vices. We have to prove that we are a class not of rowdy hooligans, but good, solid, and respectable Protestant men who are worthy of being given the vote. And of course, that is a misinterpretation, because the bourgeoisie is not denying you the vote because you're drunk. They're denying you the vote because they're terrified of the idea of you getting political rights based on class. But this was a point, this was a very big point of view, and it did motivate those early Chartists and the temperance movement, particularly the working class temperance movement, was the idea that we have to improve ourselves. It's criticized for being self-improvement, and it is, as Marx and Engels criticized it is a form of bourgeois socialism. In fact, there's a very good quote from the Communist Manifesto where, under the criticisms of other forms of socialism, Marx and Engels label this point of view from being conservative or bourgeois socialism. And he says, and they say, to this section belong economists, philanthropists, humanitarians, improvers of the condition of the working class, organizers of charity, members of societies for the prevention of cruelty to animals, temperance fanatics, hole and corner reformers of every imaginable kind. This form of socialism has moreover been worked out into complete systems. We may cite Proudhon's Philosophie de la Misère as an example of this form. Now, that's a valid criticism, but I'd say also that even though it is a point of view which has proven to be wrong, I'd say it was a point of view that was, first of all, understandable, and even though it was flawed, had beneficial effects to it. Like, even though the political points of view of those early temperance campaigners was flawed in that the bourgeoisie is not going to give you voting rights if the working class just all stop drinking overnight. But it did encourage this idea that we can, not only can we get political rights, but we deserve them. And also that, and this feeds into the Marxist idea, I think, or it can be squared with the Marxist idea of the idea of that the working class, because by raising our collective level of knowledge and understanding and collective intelligence, there's no reason why we can't become the ruling class. And I go on to argue in the essay that it's this, it's the dumping of that belief by a lot of the left, the idea that the working class can become the ruling class, that lies behind a lot of the celebration of empty libertinism that we see today.
Yeah, I think I like the temperance movement because, yes, in the sense that they were they were trying to achieve an alcohol-free society, literally, where no one drank ever. And that, obviously, they didn't achieve. But I think that given the circumstances of the time when the temperance movement emerged and what they were up against, I think that taking that position at that time was actually the correct position to take, notwithstanding Marx and Engels' criticism of the movement. I actually do think that it was dialectically correct because, like, the drinking problem in Britain at that time within the working class was, like, phenomenally bad. Like, we'll joke around and say people nowadays drink too much. Like, back then, people were like young children were drinking as a common practice. Pregnant women were drinking. Breastfeeding women were drinking. You know, people would drink as much as they could at work, and, you know, even more than that after work. Like, it was a huge blight on society. And so I think it's interesting that I think that the way in which they position themselves as proving themselves worthy for political rights versus, you know, fighting to achieve them, yes, that orientation was probably incorrect. But I think that what the temperance movement did, which I think is very exceptional, is set a higher standard and actually change the norms around drinking to in a way that seems very commonsensical to us today.
Even though they didn't achieve an alcohol-free society, they did force a series of restrictions on alcohol serving, which would have been unthinkable in the 1830s and 40s, culminating in like the licensing laws that were put in place up to 1914 and certainly after World War One. Finally, in the early, interestingly enough, though, I found out as part of the research for this, they started restricting things in Wales earlier than they did in England because of the strength of the temperance movement in Wales was even more powerful than it was in the English Northwest, which is an interesting, weird detail. You very rarely got, back in the 19th century, Welsh-only pieces of legislation, but you did get restriction on licensing laws earlier in Wales than you did in England and Scotland. But you did get restrictions on who they could sell alcohol to. Yes. Eventually, mm-hmm. You did get that the government was forced to state that, like, you can't sell alcohol to somebody who's already visibly drunk. Mm-hmm. And there would be penalties for people who were drunk whilst being responsible for children, for instance, which they would never have done that without the pressure from the temperance movement. And the licensing laws that they got in the end, which was that pubs would only be open for like a period in the afternoon and then a slightly longer period in the evening, it would be closed by 10:30. Mm-hmm. That lasted a long time. Mm-hmm. I mean, those licensing laws for public houses lasted until the late 1980s, I think. Mm-hmm. And also, it was even selling alcohol, as they would call it, off license, was heavily restricted. So, for instance, I still remember as a kid that they would seal off the alcohol aisles in the supermarkets on a Sunday.
Oh, wow.
Because it's Jesus's day. The only wine you should be drinking is communion. Mm-hmm. But that, of course, all fell away quite rapidly in the 1990s. The final sort of the ending of these licensing laws came in. They were amended and relaxed in the late 80s. And then Blair tried to usher in 24-hour drinking in the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. That largely failed. And none of the pubs actually wanted to employ people to work through the small hours of the morning serving alcohol, because the only people who are going to want that are people who were already viciously drunk.
Yeah.
So it largely failed, Blair's idea of 24-hour drinking culture. But the fact that they tried to bring it in at all does tell us an awful lot.
Well, yes, indeed. And like, I think in addition to these legislative and policy changes, there was a huge cultural shift, I think, in Britain and throughout the world with regards to people's understanding of alcohol, which was considered a health food, essentially. Like, beer was considered healthful for people of all ages. It was considered nutritious. And a big part of what the temperance movement did was educate people on their actual dangers of alcohol. And they actually shifted the medical opinion on alcohol. It was very standard for a long time in Britain, for example, to serve a few pints of alcohol to hospital patients or to serve school children alcohol at lunch. So now if we were to hear that, we'd be shocked, right?
I think there's an article in Jacobin calling for the reintroduction of school alcohol, actually.
You have to be joking, but...
I'm joking, but yeah. They'll go there.
Good, good. But I was like, it could be true. Yeah, like, and at the time, like, it was very difficult for people to take that position to say, you know, there actually might be health risks to serving children alcohol or pregnant women drinking heavily or giving alcohol to patients in the hospital. People who used to voice these concerns, including medical doctors, were called quacks and like ridiculous and things like that. But the temperance movement created the social base that made it possible for those kinds of opinions to be considered seriously. And, you know, I think that all of us today would agree that, broadly speaking, that is a correct position, both on the science moral fronts.
Serving a whole bunch of beer to people in hospitals is probably not a very good idea, but it was considered good practice. It was considered, actually, the science, to return to a theme we've often explored here, as was apparently in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, like various people would swear blind in numerous films paid for by the tobacco industry, that tobacco was good for the lungs. Mm-hmm. You just need a cigarette in the morning, warms up the lungs and gets things moving. Mm-hmm. So the science changes and also can be bought. Other thing I wanted to mention was just if you look around, even in the smallest town in Britain,
yeah,
you can see some of the legacies of the temperance movement. The various buildings for either temperance halls or, as they're often called, mechanics institutes. The temperance hall near where I live, in a final brutal joke from capitalism, has been turned into a pub, which tells you a lot about where things have gone. But the reason why they built a lot of these places was to, first of all, a lot of the mechanics institutes, as they were called, built by the temperance movement, and also occupied by the early trade union movement, were built so the working class could go to public lectures sometimes. Yeah. And Livesey used to give like very dramatic public lectures where he would be talking about the dangers of alcohol, and he would be talking about how it was poisonous and how it was, you could tell it was because it was flammable. And behind him, he would have people distilling the alcohol out of beer and spirits. And then at the end of the lecture, he'd set fire to it. Mm-hmm. Very dramatic flourish, because people didn't believe that this stuff was in there.
Yeah.
People believed that it was good for you because, of course, the science told them that it was.
Well, I think much like the way in which cannabis is increasingly presented as harmless or beneficial for stress beneficial. And anxiety relief.
I'm just changing my consciousness by eroding it.
Well, I'm just relaxing. I'm just, you know, it's just something to help me relax is very commonly.
Yes. Just, you know, like giving beer to your children.
Yeah, that does help children relax.
But it was not just about it was obviously primarily about educating people about the dangers of alcohol and urging people to sign the pledge of teetotalism, which many people did. I mean, this again, like, there's no coincidence that a lot of the late 19th and early 20th century labor movement leaders were from a background of temperance and teetotalism a lot of the time, even both on the right of the movement and on the left. But also, like, the legacy of the temperance movement can be seen in a lot of the buildings that they put up, the fact that they started using the temperance halls to provide working class men, it was often men, with other forms of entertainment other than drinking. So a lot of pub games were introduced into them. And that's where a lot of it comes from. And it's got this huge influence on a lot of the working class communities all the way across Britain that, again, largely has been relegated or forgotten about for various different reasons. But if you live in Britain, just walk around and see if there's a mechanics institute near to you, or if there's an old temperance hall, and see what's occupying it these days. Chances are it's a Wetherspoons, which is the chain of pubs that occupies all the old buildings around the place. But again, this had a huge influence. The fact that the bourgeois government had to take them seriously enough to introduce restrictions, and of course, these were restrictions that were demanded by an organized working class movement. It's often portrayed in But certainly when I learned about like the temperance movement later, it was portrayed purely as a petty bourgeois movement, a movement of sort of petty bourgeois clergymen and employers who didn't want the workers being drunk. But of course, as Engels points out, they don't mind them being drunk as long as they're turning up and can run the machinery. That was the attitude. Also, the attitude was, well, if they drink themselves to death, there's plenty more where they came from. So it was a demand of the working class, this movement to go teetotal or to severely restrict alcohol consumption, because they, it was a movement of the of working class, led by working class men and some women, who saw the potential of the working class be, in terms of intellectual potential, social potential, being squandered by drink. And I'll just read a quote from the Labour MP, an early Labour MP, John Burns, who I mentioned earlier. And he talks about this in class terms, which I think we can also apply to drug consumption. And in, this is from a lecture called Labour and Drink, which he used to give in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. It's uploaded to the Internet Archive site in pamphlet form, and I'll put the link in the show notes. He says, drinking is bad enough in the prosperous, well-fed, and comfortable classes, who can mitigate its heavy drain upon their health, strength, and resources by rest, change, and counter-attractions. But on the poor, it is an additional load piled upon their own backs, too often by their own hands, and nearly always at the time they are least able to bear it. From their strength as a class, from their powers of endurance as individuals, and their capacity as craftsmen, it is a never-ending drain. Which Burns, of course, was from the more from the sort of moralistic and sort of Methodist side of things, and made arguments around the fact that around self-improvement than the sort of revolutionary potential of the working class. But his point there, I think, is a good one, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's very true. I do think that there's a lot of like drug and alcohol consumption in our society. Like it happens very, it's very, very common. Like in Canada, for instance, like, of course, as everyone knows, cannabis is legal. In Ontario, for instance, like 2/3 of teenagers will start alcohol consumption while they're teenagers, adolescents. And so people get into it very early. And drugs as well, like increasingly cannabis is used or experimented with in teenage years as well. But I think it is quite different if you are from a petty bourgeois or bourgeois background to be doing these things versus a working class background. Because like, yes, it's true that not well everyone who drinks as a teenager or does drugs as a teenager will have some like severe effects. But it does happen pretty commonly that someone develops a habit or it distracts them from school and then they start to fall behind. So, you know, whereas a petty bourgeois or bourgeois person would be able to help their kid make up for lost time with tutoring or whatever other supports they can render them in terms of career and academic progress, that's not available to a lot of working class parents. And so, you know, any time that you lose or any intellectual capacity that you lose because of these things are often not recoupable. The effects of developing a habit or an addiction to a substance for a working class child, for instance, is quite different than a bourgeois person. And in your article, I really like how you illustrate that the difference in attitude between these classes towards drugs, I think is probably partially driven by the fact that they experience drugs in their communities and alcohol in their communities quite differently from one another. Whereas maybe in more wealthy communities, you can always make up for most issues, including health issues. You can get help, like you can purchase like private healthcare, you can purchase private therapy, whatever else. But that's not really available for a lot of working class people. So they really do suffer the full brunt of substance use much more than the bourgeois people.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the petty bourgeois radicals very rarely understand such things or proclaim that it doesn't matter or proclaim that you're actually discriminating against workers by advocating for restraint because everybody should just be able to get annihilated round the clock. I've actually had people make those arguments to me. But one of the reasons that I wanted to write this was because I think that what we've seen specifically since the 1960s has been the how capital has really offered everybody a devil's bargain, which is that the culture that became predominant in the 1960s, not only like increasing consumerism, that's part of it, but also the idea that any restriction on your personal consumption activity, or more, or like the or your choose your choice of how much drink you have, how much if you want to consume narcotics, that it's not only is it a purely personal decision, but also that there either are no social consequences, or that those social consequences are something which can only be addressed by having more of the thing that you're consuming in the first place, or easing access to it.
Well, I think that the attitude is more so that these social consequences and personal consequences cannot be eliminated. It's just impossible.
So I think the current argument that comes from, it's largely the political left, but not exclusively them. It's actually everybody from writers from The Economist through to people on the Labour left in this country through to various sort of DSA weirdos in America, is that you can't possibly stop people doing not just some narcotics, but large amounts of them. So the best thing you could do is essentially not only legalize, but not only legalize cannabis, which is the big cause celebre and has been for quite some time, but now the demand that they're making is decriminalize or legalize everything. And that on the basis of so-called harm reduction. And I think that what this symbolizes two things. First of all, it's that the left is completely dominated by like lifestyleist petty bourgeoisie, and has been for quite some time, that it's completely separated itself from the working class. That's not even a controversial point of view anymore. That's pretty well established. But also that if we look back to the debates over cannabis classification as far back as the 1960s, we can see that there was a clear division even in the British cabinet between the working class MPs and cabinet ministers and the middle class radicals, who wanted to go as far as they possibly could in legalizing this stuff, or at least severely reducing the penalties of it. Because going back to that quote from John Burns, because these were people like Roy Jenkins, Anthony Crossland, Richard Crossman, their cabinet ministers who were heavily in favor of a more relaxed government policy on cannabis, they were all from very middle-class backgrounds. And as Burns says about alcohol, they're cushioned from the impact of these things. Addiction is a real crippler and a real killer for working class, but particularly some of the more lower-wage working class communities. And, of course, it's a real dangerous thing when you go into a period where the working class has been politically and industrially defeated. There's an increased amount of alienation and atomization. And what is the political left doing? They're saying, take more drugs, get higher. And then when it gets worse and you get more addictions and people become more hooked on these things, they're saying, well, get rid of all restrictions because we can't possibly change anything. So just make sure that the state can't punish them for taking it. In my view, that's an appallingly reactionary vision. They have completely given up on and are probably, in fact, quite hostile to the idea that the working class can become the ruling class. No concept of that in any of this thought whatsoever. I mean, if you read the articles, as I did going through them in certainly in Jacobin and some of the other journals, it's all about, well, we can just make it a little bit less bad if we just stop people getting arrested. There's no concept of the fact that the severe damage that drug use does to the consciousness and intellect of people. And not only that, but the social damage that drug consumption and addiction can do across the wider working class families and communities, and the problems it can breed with, and you get like huge numbers of lumpenized elements hooked on all kinds of things. And yet the only answer they have is, well, just remove the restrictions and stop the cops arresting people. And this is like the dead end of like mainline leftism. To be fair, like some Marxist groups like the CWI, which I used to be a member of, did hold out against the freewheeling libertinist approach for a long time. But I think most of them dropped their opposition to that in the end because they're reliant on middle-class student members who want to take up free the weed as a cause. But this is where we are. And now you get these arguments that it's all about that the harm reduction is means just basically engaging in what is essentially a free-for-all and just removing all consequences. And Justin Trudeau is leading the way in this, isn't he?
Canada is legalized cannabis, and I'm writing a piece myself on this process for the compact. And it actually was a very will-o'-the-wisp, I believe is the English little idiom, a way of legalizing something. It typically is presented within a utilitarian framework. So that harm reduction reduces the harm and maximizes the benefit. But in my mind, it is quite a faux utilitarian framework because number one, there actually isn't good knowledge of the long-term effects of using cannabis, even if you just use it occasionally. There are no controlled studies with regards to this drug. It was always considered a hard drug by most countries. It still is considered a hard drug by some countries like Sweden, who actually does pursue still pursues a drug-free policy approach. And it's widely accepted by the society in Sweden that drugs are a significant social problem and that they need to be eliminated. And they have quite what people would call a repressive drug policy. But in Canada, essentially, they just made the argument around two main themes, I would say, that making weed illegal or keeping it illegal or decriminalized was coming in the way of people's personal freedom and choice, and that people should be allowed to assess risks and benefits for themselves and make a decision, and that there was a lot of tax revenue to be gotten and we could take the business out of the hands of the black market. And I think it's an interesting way of positioning this problem about freedom. Like it's been a change from freedom from drugs to freedom to do drugs. And so it's an interesting shift that is happening throughout the world. But but just to say that the utilitarian framework that the government based its assessment on, or like pretended to base its assessment on in order to legalize this thing, is not very robust. Like there actually isn't the information you would need to do a proper utilitarian analysis. But I don't think that, you know, when reading more and more about harm reduction and about drug policy and alcohol and things like that, I'm becoming less convinced by utilitarianism as a moral framework. I do think that there's some value to that way of understanding things, but I think it's problematic for a few reasons. Number one, when people consider what the good is overall, it definitely is class-based. And so the good for the bourgeoisie is obviously very antagonistic to what the good is for the working class. And number two, I do think that there is such a thing as moral categories that can be, especially in our current condition, can be pursued. Like, so for instance, like, I don't know if there's like a strict utilitarian justification for giving a high degree of education to the masses, right? Which is something I would like to see happen. You could make a pretty robust utilitarian argument that, like, you know, just let people get as much education as they like and they can just drop subjects that they don't like. And then everyone's just going to get a job anyways where they don't really use their education. So who cares? But if you have kind of like this higher value in mind, like, you know, maybe in the sense of like Kant's moral imperative, categorical imperatives, then it does set a different standard to what you would like to see out of society. But in any case, like, before getting into this, and I would like to talk about the moral aspects of what you wrote, because I think there is a denied, but in my mind, undeniable aspect, moral aspect to alcohol, drug, and other substances consumption, like pornography, etc. But I wanted to ask you, like, do you think, Alex, that the temperance movement did in fact empower the working classes on the political and class struggle fronts? Like, do you think that there's a strong case to be made with regards to that?
I think there's an undeniable case that it was part of the radicalization of the working class that led up to the Chartist mm-hmm. movement, which was incredibly significant. The fact that that as I said earlier, so many later leaders of the working class movement had come through both Chartism and temperance, or had been influenced by it, makes it a hugely significant working class movement, and makes the likes of Joseph Livesey hugely significant working class leaders. Even though, of course, they didn't attain the society that they were looking for completely, but they had an enormous influence. And so I would say it is part of British working class radicalization and the formation of early class consciousness in the 19th century. So not only hugely significant, but very positive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I would mention that it did have effects. The temperance movement, while it started in Britain, and kind of prohibition in the United States, these kind of dual poles that emerged with regards to alcohol consumption. And the temperance movement made its way to Canada and the other colonies as well. And you can see actually temperance teetotaler attitudes infect a lot of prominent trade union movements in North America as well. Like, so for instance, the Knights of Labor had the position that drink and a disciplined labor movement were incompatible. And they were a major, major trade union movement in North America at the time. One of the first trade union movements to try to organize the unskilled workers, the women workers, the black workers, and things like that. So I do think that it, certainly in terms of like its ideological effects, it was very true. But do you think there is some truth to the idea, like practically speaking, that reducing the amount of substance abuse or substance use within the working class can enable the class struggle? Like, do you think that is an exaggeration, or what do you make of that kind of approach?
I would say that that's an accurate thing, an accurate statement, are based on a couple of qualifiers. First of all, the way in which the bourgeoisie saw alcohol and the way that they see drugs now as something gives the game away largely, because they were quite happy for the, as I said earlier, for the working class to be off their faces on alcohol over the weekend, as long as they were ready to turn up at the factory gate on Monday again. Because better that they're drunk and pacified than, you know, that they gain full consciousness of their position. And if you're drunk, or in these cases, high as a kite, then you are going to be less aware of your class position and your true relation to your employer, your relationship to the means of production, your role in the labor process. All those things are blunted in terms of your awareness if you're intoxicated somehow. And I would say that the campaigning to reduce the level of alcohol and narcotic consumption, or at the very least setting a standard by which you hope to inspire people to attain that, it can play an important role in raising the level of consciousness and enabling people to actually fully appreciate their class position in a much greater way and a more profound way than they can at the moment. Because, as I say, alcohol and narcotics is there because it's there to blunt the consciousness of everybody who engages in it. And it certainly does blunt the consciousness. And this is why, as I said before, the move from the bourgeoisie has been relentlessly towards legalization of certainly cannabis and now other substances as well. As society becomes more alienated and more atomized, you'll get more of these guys who all descend from like the likes of Timothy Leary in the 60s, arguing that not only should this not be legally punished, but it's good because it takes you out of yourself. It takes you to a different place. Well, that's a terrible idea. You know, it's why on earth, if you're somebody who thinks of themselves as a Marxist, why on earth do you want the working class, and indeed the more potentially radicalizable end of the petty bourgeoisie, why do you want them to be in another place? Other than what you would want, surely, is for people to be starting to understand and truly appreciate the place they hold within the within this capitalist society. And to understand that, not be floating around in some sort of fantasy drug haze. I really do think that the embrace of this by the left is just a complete one of the most reactionary examples of how petty bourgeois fought, and more specifically, petty bourgeois thought that has its origins in ultra leftism, but then collapses, as Stalin once observed, into ultra-rightism very quickly, and pessimism, and rabid individualism, particularly this belief that drug consumption somehow is a purely personal choice. It's not. And there's, and this is another thing I wanted, the reason why I wanted to write the article is because the leftists often like put up this straw mat that it is just like Reaganites and the likes of Peter Hitchens, who are concerned about, who want to scaremonger over the social consequences of drugs and alcohol consumption. But what's actually happened is that it's only these like conservative figures who do actually mention social consequences of drug and alcohol consumption. The left's given up on that completely. And the fact and that the fact that the, it is now a field which is only really you can see conservative voices within it is, condemns the left because they've given up on this idea of people being embedded in a network of relations that exist beyond themselves. The left's given up on that completely. And so it's only really the right-wingers who are making the point about there being social consequences, whereas that should be a standard Marxist position, should start by analyzing the when it comes to these things, how the relations between the people of the working class are affected by the excessive or massive consumption of all of these substances and the fact that there is a heavy social cost to pay. But they're not doing it. And then they whinge when right-wingers step forward.
Yeah, I think that's a great point about the denial of the collective health of our society and just pretending as if these harms associated with drugs can be isolated essentially to an individual. And this is what my problem is. One of my problems with the way in which the Canadian government legalized weed, they only consider essentially like the personal effects of weed consumption. But they don't consider the network effects of weed consumption and the broader effects of what legalizing weed does, you know? So, for example, for some reason, a lot of the legislatures argued, the MPs argued that weed consumption would actually go down after you legalize weed because you could control and restrict it and regulate it more since it was in the hands of the government. But when you remove this threat of criminality, and I'm not saying that criminalization is the way of dealing with drugs in our society, but when you do remove that threat, people who are on the fence about doing weed, for example, that is removed for them as well. So actually the amount of weed consumed in all age groups increased drastically since legalization. And so these kinds of network effects are not taken into account when this utilitarian, like full utilitarian kind of framework of harm reduction is applied. And there are other social harms that just go beyond this like medical quantitative aspect of drug consumption. So for example, something that I was reminded of when I was reading Peter Hitchens' book on cannabis legalization in the UK or cannabis kind of decriminalization in the UK is the way in which cannabis in the form of hashish was broadly used in the Middle East. And my father grew up in Morocco and he came to Canada as an adult to pursue education. And something that was recollected for me when I read that is him telling me about how when he was a kid, everyone smoked hashish. It was very common. And he remembered, you know, kind of describing to me in what seemed to me a lot of pain or a lot of like regret about how everyone around him was always zoned out, including his close family members. Like it was just like something everyone did and didn't really think twice about it. And I think that like the pain of a parent, for example, seeing their child, you know, take this drug and possibly develop a habit, kind of lose their minds, become like a different person. This kind of pain that's associated with drug consumption is not taking into account. And, you know, just the broader effects on increasing the amount of drug use within the working class who, as we mentioned, doesn't have as many resources and access points to reduce the amount of severe ill effects that happen as a result of drug consumption. Because, of course, when you increase the amount of drug being used in whatever which method you want to do it, some percentage of those people will develop an addiction. It's just there's a causal link between taking a drug and developing an addiction, right? Like you need to take the drug to develop an addiction. If you never take it, you'll never develop that addiction. And so you are increasing the amount of addiction and habit forming when you do legalize something or decriminalize it. And so like that does have an ill effect. It seems to me, it seems like it's a pretty reasonable thing to say that overall this will weaken the intellectual and health and social linkages of the working class when you do increase the amount of severe drug problems that happen with an overall increase in drug use, if that makes sense.
Yeah, well, it's the denial of the social is a very strange thing for like the left to embrace, but they have really become like many of the influences of the left now has led them into a place where they're like the perfect neoliberal subject, so to speak, which is the regard that. But this reflected very strangely for some of them, because some of these characters, specifically in like Canada, the US, and Britain, were on the one level screaming that we had to be locked in our houses 24/7 during the COVID period because we might infect others. But at the same time, arguing that there's no negative social consequences from smoking large amounts of cannabis or drinking 24/7. But I suppose it does fit, because if they could be locked away 24/7 in their flat and just high as a kite, then I suppose all this does fit together, which is it's all about actively wanting a hyper-alienated, completely atomized society where nobody actually sees each other or has any real social relations to each other anymore. And everybody's so out of it, they can't see the consequences of capitalism around them. So maybe this does fit together.
Well, I think like just the, and this maybe touches on the moral aspects that I want to get to, but just the attitude that undergirds this approach. I think at least with the framework that existed before, which was about eliminating drugs, and perhaps this framework that's still promoted by the right, it at least says that, you know, you have a responsibility not just towards yourself, you have a responsibility towards, you know, the state, which isn't like the most inspiring thing, which is perhaps why it didn't work very well. But you had a responsibility to follow the law with regards to these things. But now they're just removing even that and saying that you don't have any responsibility towards anyone else with regards to your personal actions. And I think this is it's a very liberal point of view, actually, like this idea that like individuals are essentially exist a priori society at large. But it's not one that melds with a working class politics, which if it is to be successful, does have to be a collective effort and actually will have to entail a lot of self-sacrifice from the individuals involved. Like even forming a union to some extent involves some self-sacrifice. You have to sacrifice part of your wages. And, you know, you may not have any direct benefit from that union right away. And that's why some people vote against unionization, right? But, you know, even in that process, you're saying, well, it doesn't matter that some people voted, like we're going to subsume their individuality in this very vulgar sense within the trade union, because overall it has this greater good involved. And so I do think that the attitude is antithetical to, I mean, it's very beneficial for the bourgeoisie, for people to view themselves in that way, but it's very antithetical to a working class ethos that needs to be developed in the process of class struggle.
Well, it is the purest bourgeois ideology. The idea of themselves as not only as the universal class, but also as the ultimate sort of sovereign individuals, like the who can be completely free of all other ties and consequences, even though that's not strictly true for the bourgeoisie, but it is a very bourgeois point of view. It's why it's most popular with like the American libertarians, who are very big on this kind of thing. But it's a view that the left has almost entirely embraced on all the worst possible things. And also the idea of, and I did mention this in the article, the idea that there can be no restraint upon your personal habits is also a very reactionary idea. And it takes us away from really the kind of thing that you would need to actually rebuild a real communist politics these days, which is that if you read any of the great thinkers of Marxism over the last 120, 150 years, Lenin, Stalin, Che Guevara, Fidel Castro, Hoxha, people like that, all of them are actually unified when they're talking about either the new man and woman under communism or the kind of people that they need in the Revolutionary Party. It's all about living a life of restraint, abstaining from the immediate pleasure because you're working flat out for the revolution, basically, or to build the party, or to educate yourself. And also it's a life of essentially where instantaneous gratification is not just delayed but deferred indefinitely, and there has to be a great amount of self-discipline, a consistent self-discipline, which is reinforced via the collective structures of the party, which is reinforced via your relationship with the class struggle. But that's the kind of framework for the individual cadres that all these great revolutionary leaders saw as being completely necessary. And thinking about my own experience inside the left, it's a joke that we would ever compare ourselves to that. It's a joke because my experience on the British left, I've never met anybody more drunk, more out of it, more lacking in self-discipline. And I include my younger self in this as well. And more resentful of the idea of self-sacrifice, any kind of self-sacrifice at all, was regarded as appalling. And I remember when one comrade years ago now tried to say, well, should we really not have meetings in a pub? This isn't going to attract in people who might have some kind of objection. He was like shut down by the regional full-timer. He would say, hey, look, unless we let people drink, no one's going to come. Because this is what it had become. It had become a drinking club, a social club, and like none of us, I include myself in this, were serious about any of this. Because if you're serious, you're not drinking through your meeting. You're not trying to explain the intricacies of the property relations before the English Civil War whilst off your face on marijuana. You're not spending your party or conferences aren't spent almost entirely drunk. None of this, people like Lenin would laugh or have you shot, but mostly just laugh at this because it revealed really that none of this is serious. None of it. It's a game. It's a joke. It's a pathetic social club, the British left, because it's all like this. There are some individuals who stand against it, of course, and like some of the older working class members of these parties, of course, don't behave like that because they actually took part in serious struggles and still take this seriously. But none of us, the younger generation, did because we'd grown up in a time when we were immersed in this culture and took it with us into the party and changed the party for the worse. And to get back to the point about what I wanted to say in this article is like, you have to reject capital's devil's bargain now. You have to reject this framework that has been put in place since the 60s, whereby the bourgeoisie says to you, well, we're going to alienate the shit out of you. You're going to be completely atomized and completely miserable, but you can get as completely high as you like. You can get as drunk as you like. And as you're floating around in a stupefied state, like a brain floating in a fish tank, you can imagine that you're anything else other than what you are. And you have to reject all of that. And this is the conclusion I came to personally. And you have to face the world as stone cold sober and analyze it as it actually looks without any of the deadening impacts of alcohol or drugs now. Because again, speaking from a personal position, and like that, to me, like, it's the start of making a more serious commitment to actually pursuing a socialist politics, because everything else, like up to this point, I would say, in that I've experienced, has been a bad social club and a bad joke.
And that brings us to the end of part one of this discussion of the temperance movement and its implications for the modern labor movement. We'll be back with part two of this on our Patreon page next week. I hope you enjoy the program.